Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. In the last 2 years, three significant new biographies of Adolf Hitler have appeared. Our guest today, Brendan Sims, has written one of them, titled Significantly Hitler, A Global Biography. Brendan is professor in the History of International Relations in the Department of Politics and International Studies at the University of Cambridge, and he's the author of several books in European and British history. Sims's biography presents a Hitler obsessed with the Anglo-American world, both as a model and as a challenge and as a threat. And he's also interested in recognizing the importance for Hitler of the idea of international capitalism and the way in which Jews and international capitalism are intertwined. It's an absorbing new biography, one that offers both new interpretations and new details. And I'm looking forward to what should be a fascinating discussion. So with that, Brendan, welcome, and thanks for joining us on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Thank you, Kelly. Thank you very much for having me.
So, Brendan, let me start by asking what might be a simple question. Why a biography of Hitler? Why did you think this was the right time?
Well, I think that the aspects of Hitler's life, which you've alluded to, the centrality of Anglo-America, simply haven't been recognized.
So maybe you could sketch out for us something, and you do this in the book, very briefly, what have previous authors of biographies, what's the historiography of biographies of Hitler?
Well, if we focus just on the major biographies, it really begins in the 50s with Alan Bullock, and his focus is very much on Hitler in the context of the immediate post-war, in the context of totalitarianism, but also in the context of a man who is a kind of somebody who doesn't really have a coherent world view. Then you've got, in the case of Joachim Fest, in the early 1970s, a literary, very mature biography, but one which is really focused on understanding Hitler within his German context. The question being, which is still a very good question, is how could such a sophisticated and wealthy country like Germany, at least wealthy in the general context, not wealthy compared to Anglo-America, of course, how could it succumb to Adolf Hitler and Nazism? And then you had in the 1980s, a lot of focus on, and also in the 1970s, on the so-called structural view of the Third Reich, saying that it's really not just about his intention, but rather about the other competing forces within the Third Reich. And that led then really to Ian Kershaw's famous monumental two-volume biography, which appeared between 1998 and 2000, which was really written from the point of view of locating Hitler within that new literature and within German society. And then more recently, you've got Volker Ulrich, who's focusing to a considerable extent on the more psychological aspect, Hitler's personality, which perhaps had been under-illuminated hitherto. You have Peter Longerich, who is very much also a historian of Nazi bureaucracy, of individual a Nazi, somebody who again was locating Hitler fundamentally within German history, a kind of updated Kershaw in many, many respects. And then you have Wolfram Pütter, who has written a book which is not exactly a biography, but is looking at Hitler as an artist, but also as a military strategist, and if you like, the link between the military and the artistic, and has really explored the concept of genius. And all these books, I should say, are extremely valuable. But my argument is that because we haven't had Hitler in the context of his, what I would argue is really his principal obsession, which is Anglo-America and international capitalism, that I think is a dimension which needs to be added in and fundamentally changes our view of Hitler.
So maybe let's start there. Why is he so obsessed with the Anglo-American world and the challenge that it poses?
Well, that's actually quite easy to explain because, of course, as is well known, the formative experience for him is not so much Vienna, that's been debunked, but rather the First World War itself. And anybody who's fought on the principal battlefront of the First World War, which is, of course, the Western Front, will most likely have encountered the British or Commonwealth or the Empire armies. And towards the end, of course, the United States. And Hitler fights virtually the entire war against the British and latterly against the Americans. And this has a profound impact on him because he realizes immediately that this is a power of a superior type, which, of course, crushes the German Reich in battle. And secondly, you have the experience of the German home front, which is starved by the blockade, which, of course, is imposed by the Royal Navy. And then in the aftermath of the First World War, you've got the Versailles settlement, where, again, you leave aside the French for a minute, the dominant powers are the Anglo-Americans. And, of course, the world of the 1920s is dominated, certainly by the United States, but also by the British Empire. So for anybody who was there at the time, the notion that the British and the Americans and international capitalism run everything wouldn't have seemed strange.
So that's a pretty typical great power. I don't know if the explanation is right, but that's a as you've described it, that's a power dynamic, not a racial dynamic. Does Hitler have a national or a racial sense of the Anglo-American world as opponents or models, or how does that work?
Well, he does very much, and of course it drives then his vision, his view of the power political dynamic. So he comes to believe, and I demonstrate this with copious quotations and also using some new evidence coming out of his experience of the First World War, that Hitler believed that Germany's main problem was its failure to feed its population, which of course is well known, and that therefore that led to emigration, which is not an aspect which was really discussed at all in relation to Hitler, and certainly not by his biographers. And that huge emigration, we're talking about millions of people who leave the German Reich, particularly in the course of the 19th century, they then go and fertilize, this is the exact word he uses, they fertilize other countries, particularly the British Empire, but most especially the United States. And so what happens is that in his view, the best German elements, and he's very explicit about this, the best German elements, those with the most initiative and get-go, leave the Reich, and they go and they reinforce or fertilize partly the British Empire, but mainly the United States. And if you add to that the fact that in Hitler's view, the original and principal racial spine of Britain and the United States is Anglo-Saxon, so the phrase Angelsächsisch is quite central to him, then you have the feeling on his side that really all the best, and I stress here, these phrases should be in inverted commas. I'm channeling Hitler here, not views, to be absolutely explicit. but that he feels that these best elements are present doubly in Anglo-America. So they both have their own native Anglo-Saxon elements, if you like, and also the best elements from Germany, which are then, and this is very important, anglicized, is a phrase he uses, anglisieren. And he is both admiring and despairing of this, because he says that you know, really what the Americans can do is that they can turn Germans into Americans. And why does this matter? Well, it matters, first of all, because it's kind of a double whammy. The German Reich loses its best elements, and a potential enemy gains these elements. And this proves to be a problem, he says, when in the First World War, these exported Germans returned to fight the German Reich in battle. And so the sort of classic case in point for him is an encounter he has with American prisoners in July of 1918 during the Second Battle of the Marne. And we know that took place because I actually found documents in the Bavarian War Archive which showed that to be so. But what's even more important is the way in which he interpreted that event later in the 1920s, where he says, I encountered German emigrants on the battlefields of France. And that for him is then the argument that we need to have a new regime in Germany, which will secure living space in the East in order to export that excess population. And the rest, is more familiar.
So where does this idea of international capitalism as an ideology and as a practice and as a perhaps as a racialized practice, how does that fit in?
Right. So this is a very important parallel and reinforcing and interacting strand of his thinking. So he argues that the world is dominated by international capitalism. And I stress the phrase international here. Sometimes Hitler makes it sound as if he's against capitalism as such. And there certainly are times where he appears to be so. But he also has a soft spot for what he calls national capitalism, by which he means enterprises like Krupps and others, which are firmly located within the German Reich. But so his invective and his anxiety is to do with international capitalism, by which he means large corporations, but particularly also finance capital, as he calls it. And later he refers to the plutocratic powers and so on. But it's always the same thing. And he says that this international capitalism is mainly Jewish, but not exclusively Jewish. And he associates international capitalism with the power of the Jews. So he refers to people like the Rothschilds. They would be a typical case. And it's his belief that international capitalism runs the world, and that in particular, international capitalism regards national capitalism or national economies, to be more precise, with jealousy. And therefore, what the German Reich before 1914 constituted for international capitalism was a rival. And what do you do with a rival? Well, according to Hitler, you isolate it diplomatically, and so that's how he explains the countdown to 1914. You go to war with it, but you also inflict subversive and disintegrative elements on it. Mm. So hence, for example, the support of international capitalism for trade unions or socialism or even communism within the German Reich, because these are sort of whips and scorpions in Hitler's view, which are used to break up national economies and make them subject to international capitalism.
One of the let's back up. How and when did Hitler become anti-Semitic?
Well, that of course is the $64 million dollar question.
Yep.
There was a time when it was very plausibly linked back to his time in Vienna when he encountered many Jews. But in fact, over the last 25 years or so, that view has been increasingly discredited. There was a very good book by a lady called Brigitte Hamann on Hitler's Vienna, which showed that, in fact, he had had quite friendly relations with Jews in Vienna. And there's no evidence of any anti-Semitic statement by Hitler, even during the First World War. So everything that we think we know about Hitler's view on Jews prior to 1919 is something that was either said subsequently by Hitler, for example, in Mein Kampf, which is totally misleading in this regard, or by somebody else about Hitler. The only concrete evidence that we have for anti-Semitic views comes from 1919. And here, and this links back to the anti-capitalism point I was making earlier, it's absolutely clear on both occasions the reference is, in the first instance, it's somebody who witnesses a speech given by Hitler, and it's a speech on capitalism. And the listener said, we don't have the text of that speech, we simply have what the listener said. And the listener says that he touched on, when he was talking about capitalism, Hitler touched on, quote, indeed he had to touch on the Jewish question. So it's very clear that the link there between capitalism, anti-capitalism, and anti-Semitism is there in Hitler's mind, also in the mind of the listener. Secondly, of course, most famously, in the notorious Gemlich letter from September 1919, when he's replying to somebody who's written to him from Ulm, who said, why should we be anti-Semitic? And Hitler lists the various reasons why one should be anti-Semitic. Among these reasons, and this is now nearly 2 years after the Bolshevik Revolution, Hitler does not mention communism, but he does extensively mention, among other things, but very prominently, anti-capitalism. So Hitler is an anti-capitalist and an anti-Semite before he's really preoccupied with the Bolshevik Revolution. Mm. So the root of his anti-Semitism is to do with his anti-capitalism, particularly his anti-international capitalism, that I should stress. Mm-hmm. And I don't, by the way, just to be absolutely clear, mean to suggest, therefore, that socialism or socialists are inherently anti-Semitic. Yeah. That can be the case for some, more than you might think. But obviously, I'm not saying that people like Willy Brandt or others are anti-Semitic. That would be absurd.
So one of the things I found fascinating in your book is the question of time. And you talk about how time speeds up and slows down for Hitler. Yeah. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So it's very clear from Hitler's own writings and rhetoric. And I don't think it's just eyewash for him. I think he is moving between different conceptions of the timeline for the realization of his plans. It's well known that in the early 1920s, he regarded himself as not so much as the Messiah, but as what he calls the drummer, a kind of a John the Baptist figure. And that at some point, probably rather earlier than most people had thought, he came to think of himself actually as the Messiah. So there's that element, first of all, that right at the beginning, it's not actually clear whether he is the man who's going to effect the change. But then, depending on the situation, it's not at all clear whether it's clear in some cases that he thinks that his goal is actually quite far off, and sometimes he thinks the goal is quite close. So to give you some examples, there's a sort of escalating expectation on his part in 1922, 1923, that salvation is actually quite close. And that's what leads him then into his mistaken or misjudged move in the famous failed putsch of November 1923. Then, of course, he ends up in prison and he's released and he has to rebuild the party. And at that point in the late 1920s, he actually is thinking in much more long-term perspective. Then time shortens again in 1931, 32, and he takes over power. But even then, despite the fact he's looking, on the one hand, to move quite quickly on the military front, as he tells the military leaders in February 1933. At the same time, he's talking about the transformation of the German people as a very long-term project, and the completion of which he himself will not witness. He says sometimes that, you know, I'm simply going to move the marker a little bit further along. And if you think of his project as a project in the end designed either to confront or at least to balance Anglo-America, then this is very understandable, because his theory of the rise of the United States, and particularly the British Empire, is that they have developed what he regards as their superior qualities over hundreds of years of conflict and what he calls racial development. And the Germans have failed to do that for various reasons. And so, of course, to put the Germans in the position that the British are, in theory, he's going to need hundreds of years to do it. And so you then end up with a rather longer timeline. So time expands and contracts, this is the point, depending on the context.
And I'm struck in your biography by how much time you spend talking about ways he tries to I guess the word would be elevate the German people. And you talk about architecture and you talk about music and you talk about a variety of different things that are often not treated in biographies of Hitler. So maybe you could say, how does he try and move time along within the Reich?
Mm-hmm. Well, he has a very holistic view of what he calls racial development, elevation, as you say. So Hebung is the phrase in German. Which in itself shows that his view of the German people, even without the so-called undesirable elements like Jews or the disabled or whatever, even the baseline of the German people, he regards as fundamentally problematic. So the German people he wants and the German people he would like to have are two very different things. And he makes a distinction, which is very important and is not always understood, between the German people and the Nordic race. So he regards the German people as made up of many different racial strands. He says this on a number of occasions, particularly in secret speeches, of which the Nordic race, so-called, is only one. And in fact, he thinks that other racial strands, which can include Slavs, but also Alpine or others, may have more artistic sentiments. So what you would want to try to do would be to increase the Nordic element from the point of view of your position in the world, but not completely neglect the other aspects. Now, how do you then improve, in inverted commas, your race? Well, you can do this on several fronts, but there are really two key aspects. One is to eliminate the so-called negative elements. So that's the negative eugenics. And that, of course, is very well known. Mm-hmm. But then you have the so-called positive eugenics. These are terms from eugenic studies, as it were. And that involves developing the more positive strands within the race. And you do that, first of all, by raising the standard of living. So he says a big problem in Germany is that a lot of people are actually quite poor. They're easily attracted by the bright lights of America, so they might emigrate. But even if they don't, if they're poor, they're ignorant, then they will be of low racial quality. So raising the living standards is a huge part of racial development, as he sees it. But secondly, you want to ennoble and develop the mind and the culture. And that's where what you referred to with architecture and with music comes in, that he regards the appreciation of music as part of this sort of sifting, racial sifting. If you appreciate good music, in his view, then you're developing your best racial characteristics.
So I know your time is short, but I can't let you go without asking you then the obvious next question, which is, why the Holocaust?
In Hitler's mind, and this won't be news to anybody, the war against the Jews, it is a war which is waged globally, is part of the overall struggle, in his view, for the survival of the German Reich. And so he sees the Jewish threat as a threat to the coherence of the German, of the Nordic race, which we've mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. He sees Jews as internally subversive, so supportive of fragmentary tendencies within Germany, like Communist Party, like liberalism, like democracy, and essentially also as agents of the outside enemy, particularly of international capitalism. And finally, he sees the opposing powers, particularly Anglo-America and later, of course, the Soviet Union, as being directed by the forces of international Jewry. And so he sees German Jews and later European Jews as hostages in his hands for what he calls the good behavior of the British and the Americans. So that in effect, once the United States has gone to war, he's gone to war, actually declared war on the United States on the 11th of December 1941, then the final gloves come off. So obviously there have been large-scale murders in the Soviet Union prior, but that was in the context of Operation Barbarossa. But the murder of the Western European Jews is conceived very clearly as a blow against the United States. And we know this because he warns, in inverted commas, in January 1939, that he will plunge, that if in inverted commas again, world Jewry succeeds in plunging Europe into war again, then the price will be paid by the Jews. And then afterwards, then on the 12th of December, he tells the Gauleiter, and we know this because Goebbels writes it in his diary, he says, well, now the world war is here, and the Jews must pay the price. So the link between that sort of global conflict against Anglo-America, particularly the United States, and the murder of the Jews is very direct.
So then my last question, given what you've uncovered in this book, what does this book lead you to rethink or maybe to explore further in the broader history of the Nazi period or Germany in this period? What should we ask now that we have your book?
Well, I think some of the questions that one might ask more broadly are in fact already being asked. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting is that in terms of Hitler biographies, what I've just said and we've just talked about hasn't really featured, mm-hmm. With the exception perhaps of what I've been saying about the Holocaust here, but all those racial, Anglo-Saxons and emigration, that hasn't featured. Actually, the idea that the United States is a central reference point for the Third Reich as a whole is quite well established. So I would refer here particularly to Adam Tooze's on the German war economy, for example, mm-hmm. which shows that very, very clearly, that they regard the principal adversary in terms of production as the United States. And of course, the work of Philip Gassert mm-hmm. And others has shown the salience of the United States in terms of cultural conflict. So I think actually quite a lot of these questions are already being posed. Mm-hmm. So I think the idea that the Third Reich's main preoccupation was the contest at every level, cultural, economic, and military, with the West rather than primarily with the East. I think that is probably increasingly finding acceptance.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a fascinating book. I learned a lot, and I encourage people to reach out and read it and engage with it and think about it. Brendan, I know you've got to run. Thank you so much for being with us in New Books in Genocide Studies. And I hope sometime down the road we'll have a chance to have you on the show again.
Thank you very much indeed for having me.
All right. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.